Suzuki Roshi says in the little section called Attachment, Not Attachment, or Non-Attachment, Zazen practice and everyday activity are one thing. We call Zazen everyday life, and everyday life Zazen. But usually we think, now Zazen is over, and we will go about our everyday activity. But this is not the right understanding. They are the same thing. We have nowhere to escape. So in activity, there should be calmness, and in calmness, there should be activity. Calmness and activity are not different. Each existence depends on something else. Strictly speaking, there are no separate individual existences. There are just many names for one existence. Sometimes people put stress on oneness, but this is not our understanding. We do not emphasize any point in particular, even oneness. Oneness is valuable, but variety is also wonderful. Ignoring variety, people emphasize the one absolute existence, but this is a one-sided understanding. In this understanding, there is a gap between variety and oneness. But oneness and variety are the same thing, so oneness should be appreciated in each existence. That is why we emphasize everyday life rather than some particular state of mind. We should find the reality in each moment and in each phenomenon. This is a very important point. So, something that's in my mind and heart today, and possibly it's true for some of you as well, although it could be that you've been here so long that time and space have ceased to have any meaning for you. And if so, my apologies for jerking you back into time and space. Today is January 19th, 2017. And tomorrow is January 20th, 2017. And tomorrow, something will happen that will probably, but not certainly, but I would say the chances are pretty high, change the way we live fundamentally and profoundly. When our new president takes his oath of office, his hand on the Bible, facing the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, in that moment, it's hard to know how to meet an event of such profound implications. There was a sweet and, I guess, funny, but also, I don't know, it struck me as kind of, slightly devastating cartoon in The New Yorker recently, showing our president-elect facing Chief Justice Roberts, and Chief Justice Roberts holding out a marshmallow. And the caption is, "I can give you this marshmallow now, or if you wait 15 minutes, I'll give you two marshmallows and I'll swear you in as the next president of the United States." If you don't know what that's a reference to, it's a psychological study that was done with children with short attention spans to see if they could develop the capacity to wait for something better or just take the marshmallow. And many, many, many children below a certain age just couldn't even conceive of waiting to get two marshmallows. So they would take the one marshmallow. I guess it also, in my fantasy life, raised a little hope for me. Maybe he would take the marshmallow, and then something else would happen. So this is going to happen, and some of us are looking forward to a life where we need to step forward and take some action to prevent things that, or at least to contribute to preventing things that might be devastating for many of us. Some of the promises that have been made about repealing certain laws that benefit hundreds and thousands and probably millions of people. This will affect immigrants, Muslims, people below the poverty line who depend on health care from the government. It will affect someone we know, even if we don't know that it affects us directly. And because we are all one body, it will, of course, affect us directly. So since the election, at least in the Boundless Way Sangha, we've done a few things at the Zen Center in Cambridge, the Greater Boston Zen Center. There's been a forum, and continuing the work of working at the food pantry, a joint effort by people at Greater Boston and here at the temple to work with the local system of jailing people and finding justice for people who are incarcerated. David and I have been to many rallies, interfaith rallies, and on Saturday, our Dharma holder, Diane Fitzgerald, will be going down to the Women's March, and our own local activist, Joanne, I think, will be going to Boston, to the local march in Boston. And these are the things that we can do, and there's going to be more that we do. But it's very important to take Suzuki Roshi's guidance here, because there is protest and despair and difficulty. There is fear and sadness. And there are the three poisons always active in us: greed, anger, delusive certainty. And if we act from those places, our work in the world will be limited and bounce back against us, hostility against hostility. Well, this is not our way. It is the human way. But the way of Zen is to see that the practice we do here in the temple, at the Zen Center, at our local practice groups, wherever we happen to be sitting, is the same identical practice that we bring out into the world. One of our Dharma ancestors, one of the ancestors in one of our Soto lines, Robert Aitken Roshi, wrote a lovely book about the precepts. He wrote it quite a long time ago. It's probably around from the same era or a little bit later than Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And the book is called The Mind of Clover, and I just want to read you a little bit from The Mind of Clover, because it's relevant here, and it's very relevant to me. And it's also relevant to me because the other thing that's been happening for me during these 3 weeks almost of sitting at the coming and going sesshin with our wonderful, inspiring friend, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, is that I miss talking about koans. And those of you who know me know that I often give Dharma talks, Teisho, about koans, and I haven't been doing that for the past few weeks. So, like Aitken Roshi, I'm going to start with a koan. So Aitken Roshi quotes case 25 from the Blue Cliff Record. The hermit of Lotus Peak held forth his staff before his assembly and asked, "When the ancient ones reached this, why didn't they stay there?" The assembly was silent. Answering for his listeners, he said, "Because it has no power for the way." And later in this koan, the hermit continues and says, he holds out his staff and he says, "After all, what is this?" And again, everyone is silent. And he says, "Holding my staff across the back of my neck, going to the 10,000 peaks." And Aitken Roshi comments, "The myriad peaks are not mountains of isolation, but the peaks and valleys of our lives." So we say, if we just sit here and think that Zazen is it, and not see that Zazen is our life, not see that everything we do is a form of the practice, that everything that happens is a form of the practice and a demonstration of the awakened heart that is the Buddha heart. The heart of a Buddha is one that has awakened. And what do we awaken to? We awaken to everything. That means we awaken to greed, anger, and delusive certainty, as well as joy and happiness and calmness. And Suzuki Roshi says, all these things are the same. They're all just different manifestations of the awakened heart. So we learn this here in the stillness and silence, sitting upright in the middle of everything. We learn how to be in the middle of everything and to take steps to help to heal the world, because we're bodhisattvas. We are not, I learned this term from David's teacher, George Bowman, we are not miserable arhats. An arhat is someone in original Buddhist teaching who sits with a great devotion to awakening and then has an awakening and then continues to cultivate their awakening through all these different stages until they become done with the world. And we, in the Mahayana tradition, and especially in the Zen tradition, call those people miserable arhats because they are so limited. Everything is about the practice as limited to upright sitting practice, to study of the sutras, to chanting and bowing and walking, without understanding that getting in a car and going to work is a version of chanting and bowing and walking. And going to a protest rally in Washington or in Boston or here in Worcester on the steps of City Hall is a way of chanting and bowing and walking. This bodhisattva practice, this bodhisattva meaning wisdom being, the wisdom being of the great vehicle, is someone who is devoted to not stopping with our limited self as the be-all and end-all of our practice, but moving forward, becoming as Diane and Fran have worked, and many other Sangha members have joined them, on becoming eco-sattvas, beings who are awake to the inter-being of the world. And at this time of crisis and shift in the culture of our country, and I believe in the whole world, we see this happening in many different countries, in many different religious institutions, a tendency probably born out of fear to contract the heart, to no longer open to everything that is possible in this great human beingness that we all have. This contraction can cause blindness and that delusive certainty that I mentioned. So the hermit of Lotus Peak holds up his staff and he asks his Sangha a question. There are many places in our inherited koan literature where somebody asks a question, a teacher asks a question, and nobody says anything. One of the most famous ones being the monks of the Eastern and Western Hall arguing about a cat. And the teacher, Nanchuan, says, say something or I will kill this cat, and no one says anything. And out of Nanchuan's great loving heart, out of his seeing that these are people who are stuck in the limited view, in the miserable arhat view, nobody says anything. Nobody does anything. It's like a whole bunch of ostriches just turning away. A cat is about to be slaughtered, and no one says anything. The silence of the Sangha is profound, and it's not the good kind of silence, which we sometimes celebrate in other koans. It's a miss. It's coming up to bat and putting your bat down and walking off the field. It's giving in to despair. Many years ago, David and I did a workshop with the Buddhist teacher, Joanna Macy. And the workshop was called Despair and Empowerment. And the morning was spent opening up to our despair through our sitting practice. And she led us through, and this was probably 30 years ago. We think things are bad now. Well, we thought things were bad then. Through the reality of the possibility of nuclear holocaust, of the ecosystem failing and falling apart, of all the things that have just become worse over the last 30 years, despite everything that we've done, racial injustice, wars being fought overseas and even in our own communities in smaller ways. And we sank into the despair, and she encouraged us to go there as deeply as possible. That was before lunch. And then after lunch, she asked us to use the energy of our despair to really come together and see, what could we do? How could we move forward? Instead of just being silent and turning away, she said, how will you move forward? And wonderfully, David actually ended up working with Joanna for a while, being her assistant, at least in one, maybe more, of these workshops. And this became part of the style of the way we teach, this really teaching people to face what's here, to not turn away, to not avoid it, to face anger when it arises, to face great fear, to face the suffering in the body, the suffering in the mind that keeps trying to figure out, what should I do, what should I do, what should I do? The suffering that is so much at the core of how we understand Buddhism. And not to stop there. Not to stop there, but to see that all this stuff that arises is energy. It's trapped energy. It's limited energy. It's narrowed energy. And the only thing that we can possibly do with that energy, we could try to sit on it and not do anything. We could turn away and be silent. And we know, if we study history, how effective that can be, really effective. Letting things happen that will be so harmful, maybe out of fear or despair or anger or frustration or hopelessness. And so in these koans where there's silence, nobody says anything, nobody comes forward, the teacher then, out of great love, shows the consequences of that silence. And in this koan, the Hermit of Lotus Peak says, the reason the ancient ones were able to reach this, and what he means is the awareness of the awakened heart, the fullness of being a human being in the world. Why didn't they stay there? Why wasn't that enough for them? Why didn't Shakyamuni Buddha, when he woke up one morning from his long sitting and fighting the forces of Mara and discovering things and saw the morning star, why didn't he just stay there under the Bodhi tree? Why did he get up and cause this whole mess that we call Buddhism? Why did he do that? Why do people who realize something then move forward into their lives, encourage others to do the work that they can do? Every single one of us is only capable of doing what we can do. We can't, like Superman in the old Superman movie, change the axis of the earth and turn everything back. I wish we could, but we don't have that kind of power. What is the power for the way? It's what we are uniquely suited to do, and every one of us here has something that we can do. What I can do is go to rallies and speak from the Zen perspective about not othering, not dividing our hearts from those we disagree with. Encouraging people to go forward and do whatever they can do. That's what I can do. Maybe what you can do is go on a march or organize, or maybe if you're a politician, you actually fight valiantly in the minority to not let things get so bad. It always reminds me of the story of the Sleeping Beauty, where the little baby Aurora has been born, and all of the fairy godmothers are coming forward and giving the baby all these wonderful attributes, beauty and various things. And then the evil fairy comes and curses the baby. And one fairy has waited, stepped back, so that she can possibly help to repair the curse. This is what we can do. We can move forward to possibly, in our own way, repair the curse. And then the koan goes on, and the hermit of Lotus Peak talks about this. He says, I can hold my staff, that is, the teachings that I've discovered here in my zazen, and take them everywhere, going to the 1,000, the 10,000 peaks. And Aitken says, the myriad peaks are not mountains of isolation, but the peaks and valleys of our lives. If we think zazen is about sitting still on a cushion, then we haven't yet realized what zazen is. If we think our responsibility stops with being awakened, then we are miserable arhats indeed. To be a bodhisattva means to walk forward into our lives. As we say at the end of the Oxfording pictures, and the Oxfording pictures are great if you haven't seen them. There are sketches of them on the walls of the Greater Boston Zen Center. And the journey of someone who realizes awakening, and then there's one that just everything is dropped away, and there's the beautiful Zen circle, the Enso. And it doesn't end there. The final Oxfording picture is returning to the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. And this is a picture of the bodhisattva walking into life. This is a picture of us taking what we learn here and utilizing it, not just for our own happiness or the happiness of our friends and loved ones, but for the sake of the burning world. This is our duty. This is our obligation as Zen practitioners, as people of the way. Why didn't they stay here? Because it has no power for the way. The way needs engagement. And I just want to read you a little bit from the end of the essay that this comes from in The Mind of Clover, from Robert Aitken. He says, we must save the world, but we can only save it by saving little pieces of it, each of us using his or her own small, partial ability. The task is clear and very difficult. First, we must set about changing our self-centered attitudes as individuals and search out our self-nature under the guidance of a good teacher. Next, the day after we begin to practice, that is, we must set about applying our understanding in the world. This can be overtly a life of service, such as teaching or social work, or it can be service with no tag on it, parenting and working in a store. Finally, on the second day of practice, we need to put our heads and hearts together in synergistic energy to apply the Dharma as a Sangha. And he says, I am tired of hearing people say that the application of the teaching is an individual matter. This is the lazy position of someone who does not really take the bodhisattva vows seriously. If we want to save all beings, we can do it efficiently and effectively together, step by step, networking, intra-networking. And here are Suzuki Roshi's words once again. Maybe you can hear the implication in them. Zazen practice and everyday activity are one thing. We call Zazen everyday life, and everyday life Zazen. But usually we think now Zazen is over, and we will go about our everyday activity. But this is not the right understanding. They are the same thing. We have nowhere to escape. We have nowhere to escape. So in activity, there should be calmness, and in calmness, there should be activity. Calmness and activity are not different. We have nowhere to escape. Thank you. So, please make yourselves comfortable, and this is the time for our Dharma dialogue. And questions, observations, objections? Yes, Gore?
I just want to say I can't even express how grateful I feel for this dialogue. I guess because I've had a feeling, feeling like real genuine warmth and community in this sangha, but in some ways haven't felt, at home. Just out of having a difficulty reconciling my identity, as an activist and being engaged in the activist and anarchist community in Worcester. And the way that I've always approached my Zen practice is related to a lot of what you're talking about. That these things aren't, that it's not an individual matter, and I'm just very grateful that I do feel that opening there.
I think it's, thank you for saying that, and it is an edge for all of us, and we so treasure the silence here and this work that goes on in the cushion. And I think this bodhisattva path of really getting exactly what you're saying, this is the Dharma you already know, right? This is not an individual matter. And I think some of us are waking up to that in ways we haven't been before or haven't been for a while. So this great work ahead of all of us human beings, not just sitting on the cushion, but engaging in the world with great courage and with this compassion to see that it can appear either or. Are you going to cultivate yourself or are you going to work in the world? And of course it's not the self and the world. For us to imagine we're not connected is such a mistake. So thank you for being
curious. Yeah.
Two things came together for me. Thank you so much for Afundari, what you said. One way, being very sensitive to what's been occurring, my thought came when Trump received an election. What's next is resistance. And from personal experience, when I was young in Greece and the Nazis occupied the country and the city I was in, there was resistance. Some of the people went into the mountains and they fought the Germans that way. Others stood idly by, and others did what they could to help people in hiding. And what kind of collides for me about proceeding is the notion of what can we do, what can I do? And the answer comes back, and there's a lot of spirit in what you spoke, and that is to resist. Don't take it for granted what has happened, and wait for better days. Throw sand into the gears of this new machine wherever we can. and enroll others. And be patient. One of my fatalistic kind of attitudes is that, well, what difference can I make? And the world is so huge. And what comes back is, well, as has been the focus you've given me this time around at this retreat, is be in the moment.
I also want to thank you. I think that was very inspirational. And I've been struggling over the last few days with the decision to come. It was an easy decision 2 months ago, but as the inanities in Washington and around the country pile up and as more and more mobilization takes place, it was hard to say, well, I'm not going to be in Boston. So I feel very much the way you feel, and I think that I've always felt that one of the strongest attractions I had to this as a form of practice was the activation of compassion. That compassion was not something preached from a pulpit or that sort of flew over your head in metaphysical swirls, but it had to be brought into the world. And I very much look forward to being part of this community as it moves in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, such a lovely point. And, this practice, you know, touching into hearing the cries of the world, letting that touch us and fill us with compassion. And then, you know, moving out from that place and gathering energy from this oneness and this need to do what we can to act in the world in support of all beings, and this sense of so many beings being in peril right now, and how do we meet this? And for me personally, it's quite a struggle. So I, you know, have not been as active as you or Gordon in the world. And, you know, here is this very clear call to something needing to be done here. And how am I going to respond? It is quite a koan, right? But as you point out, you know, to only rage against the machine without connecting with this deep oneness and compassion for the world doesn't feel right to me either. There needs to be this balance of finding this sense of oneness and using that uprising of compassion as the power that we use to move into the world, as Melissa was saying. Yeah.
Yes. So there's a book that I'm reading that feels like the most important book I've ever read right now. It's called Radical Dharma, which Melissa, you said you were familiar with. And part of it, they talk about sort of this divide between activist communities and more like spiritual communities or spaces of healing. In that, like, in activist communities, there is this, like, almost unhealthy focus on anger and coming from a place of anger and outrage, and like that being the only place where resistance can come from. And I've confronted that in my practice a lot because I've had a lot of anger at myself from belonging to so many dominant identities, like as a white person, as a male, I've kind of had a hatred of myself for those things, and sort of thought that it's not, and this is something that they talk about in this book, like I felt like I don't deserve to heal, I guess, as someone who perpetuates violence in these different ways, just by virtue of my identity. And I realized that, like, I don't know how profound it is for me to realize that, like, that I, as a white person, I do need to heal, and I do suffer from the violence that I participate in. And, like, I think there's such profound potential in sort of a merging of these two communities. Like, there's a lot that people in activist communities have to learn from different spiritual practices, especially Zen. This is something that I think about a lot and about a lot. And the other way around, too.
Right. Yeah. Well, the other day, I talked about Martin Luther King. This, it also coincided with Martin Luther King Day. And it's the same kind of thing, that to bring love and compassion and wisdom to our activism seems essential. And yet I grew up in an activist family in the 50s, and there was so much anger, you know, about the, and fear, a lot of fear too, and hopelessness in a way. You know, my parents fought for racial justice and against the war in Vietnam, and my mother always tells me the story about being pregnant with me during another dark time in our country's history, during the McCarthy era. And she was terrified every time the doorbell rang that it would be the FBI to take her away. I feel like I bathed in utero. Some sort of paranoia, right? That's where my paranoia comes from. But I never trusted the government. They made sure that I didn't trust the government. And as I got older and grew up in the 60s, and you know, there were all this activism, this is what I saw. I saw this divide, right? And my mother was worried about me when I started practicing Zen, because she thought I was turning away from this. But so I think this coming together, which is happening now, and happened. Aitken Roshi wrote this book. I'm really curious about the copyright on it.
80s.
Was it in the 80s? Oh, there's a picture of him. Mm. 1984. Yeah, 1984. It's very dated in a lot of ways, but he was a big activist in bringing the two communities together in his day, and started the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and, you know, along with Thich Nhat Hanh and some other people. So I think it, you know, and then we sort of got lazy, and now, yeah, crisis. So everybody's coming forward, and this book, Radical Dharma, just came out. It's a very hopeful time in a way, even though it seems very dark and like we're stuck in something difficult. I think because we can use this energy in this way. You know, Esther, you had your hand.
Yeah, it's good that some time passed because my heart was beating really fast.
Give you a little break.
And when it does that, it's when something's really important to me. So, living in a completely different country and yet being part of this world, I'm also thinking that I often think about this. Some disaster happens in the world, and we wake up to all the suffering that's been going on the whole time. You know, people are starving in Africa every day. There are, you know, disasters everywhere, but something radical happens, and we wake up. And so if we try to keep that large perspective on that, yes, we have the president-elect and this thing happening tomorrow, but there's so much already going on that requires that we wake up. Just to remind ourselves of that. And then the other thing that comes to my heart is about, but isn't it also when we take the two together that through our practice we find out what is my contribution? Mm-hmm. And in whatever small or large way. For some people it is to demonstrate, to walk rallies. For other people it's something different.
That's right.
And to really use the kind of I suppose, skillful means or sensitivity in our practice to find out where is it that we can come forward. Because we can get into these ways of, oh, these ways are more right to be activist that way, or and just find out where is it that we can work, like what does our life allow for, and it can be in very small ways, I think, very small ways also.
Oh yes.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think sometimes that's, you know, my daughter's father is an animal welfare activist and has been for many years, and he started out with anger and then he moved into much more skillful means, mm-hmm. And reaching much further, not creating distance but creating intimacy and connection with people. And so sometimes we've had that argument, so what is more important, to get out and stand on the soapbox and yell or work in subtle ways? Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's one or the other. Mm-hmm. It's,
no. And I feel like it has to be aligned with our hearts. So if the subtle ways are the ways, you know, writing, organizing, running a temple, or whatever it is, or going to the food pantry, or, you know, going to a march, it doesn't matter what we do. I think the only thing, well, and even, I was going to say the only thing that wouldn't be useful would be turning away, but actually turning away is also important, because sometimes we have to turn away to allow ourselves to prepare for when we turn back. So all of it is the awakened heart in action.
I'm resonating with what everyone's saying, and thinking that when I'm most passionately aroused, that's when my mind goes to trying to create dualities. Right?
Yes.
It's either activism or it's contemplation. Mm-hmm. I'm a white privileged guy who's harming people just by existing, or I'm a decent Buddhist who's trying his best. There are those Trump supporters who we've got to fight against and throw sand in their gears for. And I think that for me, it's when I'm most passionately aroused that I want to make these separations. And so the challenge I'm finding is, how do I stay passionately aroused and come back to that place of oneness and compassion from which I can act? And I think all of us are struggling with this. It's, as Melissa was saying, it's not either or. It's not contemplation or activism. It's not privilege or being one of the people. We are all messy beings, and so we try our best to do what little we can, but we keep trying.
And I think too about cultivating courage to have confidence. So it's so easy to get sucked out in, I should be doing what someone else is doing, or I don't know, or if I do this, what if? And I think in some very genuine way, on the cushion, we actually are cultivating the capacity to show up and do something.
Yeah.
Because we can't know what the outcome is going to be, and we can get scared on the cushion. I'm confused. Again and again, with this posture and with this willingness, whatever it is, that this is my life, and how to do that, not just here on the cushion. Mm-hmm. You know, Laura, you were talking, one of the things you chose was about when we find our true way, it is the Buddha way. And so whatever we choose, from this place of trusting what we know, trusting that deepest heart of compassion, and then stepping forward to meet our life in the way each one of us has something to do that only we can do. And if we hold back, because, well, who am I? Or it doesn't, it, you know, there is this trust that is required to step out in whatever way calls to us in the moment.
Laura?
Just continuing the flow, when Bob spoke that about, you know, whenever you're the most passionate, and Gordon's comment about, you know, the two different worlds or two different communities, you know, activist and spiritual. And so what I notice for myself is that when anger arises and fear arises, there's a great deal of energy, a lot of power, you know, especially with anger, a lot of power. And I was thinking about compassion and how often for me it appears as a softening. And what arose for me in the moment was the energy of the softening. You know, not the same kind of like of the anger, like the like, you know, that kind of, but still a very powerful and moving energy of the softening of my heart. And to you know, to watch my mind make up these definitions and ideas about where the energy can come from, thinking that, oh yeah, but it's the energy of, you know, look at all these people, they have such great energy and but they're angry and they're, you know, and they're afraid and they're moving, and realizing that energy can arise as any number of things, that energy can come forth from the I'm afraid to the, you know, to the I don't know what to do, to the and the I am angry but I don't want to act from anger. You know, we have a precept of not indulging in anger, not harboring ill will, right? And so how can I sense the energy, however it arises? Because when it does, it also tends to, my experience is it moves in a direction, and if I align with that, then I amazing things happen. It's when I decide. Only this energy is good over here, and I'll do that. or the other thing is when I ignore where the energy is, or clamp it down, or, you know, whatever. So just, you know.
Well, and on that note, let's return to our zazen, trusting these energies in whatever form they arise.